rights are then told and that additional litigants can be brought in.
I can just tell you that what my experience was in the case that we had up in Anchorage. The case was probably will be appealed to the Supreme Court. That exact situation happened. We were a defendant. The plaintiffs knew about another potential party. The court ruled that we would be responsible for the negligence of that party unless they were brought in. I think what I said yesterday is I think that it is probably an open question as to whether the statute is told. The way it worked out in that case, the plaintiffs agreed that they would not have a claim, and they accepted the proposition that they did not have a direct claim against that third party. And so we went to court on that case, and it was actually tried where that third party had no exposure to the judgment. The only reason they were there was for purposes of establishing a percentage of fault. Now, they were ultimately dismissed out in the jury selection process. But those were the facts in that case.
Could I ask Mr. Lesmeyer if in that case that your client would have a right to a civil claim against the defendant who was left out?
They were joined solely for purposes of establishing an allocation of fault. And the judgment that was made by everybody there was that we would not be responsible for their fault if we joined them, and that the plaintiff did not have a direct action against them. I think the point is an open question, but I'm just telling you right now that's a problem.
Mr. Chairman, I submit then that the way to fix that might be to clarify whatever the court rules are with respect to making sure that everybody can get in the courtroom, but not by setting up such an imbalanced playing field as I believe this amendment or what's in the bill currently does. In fact, I'm not going to suggest that this bill will even make it through the process, but if it does, this section alone is ample justification for a veto, more than ample. It is such an unfair provision that I cannot believe that anyone with any reasonable person or legislator would consider this type of language. I think it sets the playing field way off balance. I also want to say that in cases, as Mr. Lesmeyer has indicated, I have no doubt that in some cases there are plaintiffs who wait until the statute is almost run out before they file their claim. I'll also say that defendants and their attorneys oftentimes stonewall and will not provide ample information to the plaintiff until the point that they end up having to file suit, so that the information that they may need in order to have as accurate a claim as possible before the courts, that opportunity is not provided for. That's my impression of how our justice system works. And the idea that because you can't make everybody because the system doesn't work well for everybody, that you would in fact make it worse for everybody somehow helps those people who now might have an opportunity. The logic of that just escapes me.
Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't, since the committee's already taken action on the amendment, I won't take too much time except to say that the same provision was in a bill last year that received some critical analysis from the AG's office, but in fact they said that section is necessary because of the uncertain state of the law based on what is or isn't still in effect, and as was mentioned before, we can fix it with statute or we can fix it with court rule. And I really think that it's the legislature's job to write laws and not the Supreme Court.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would say that with respect to court rule changes, that perhaps the third branch government might have both better expertise and knowledge of the subject and be better the better place to address those types of issues. But I know that there could be some disagreement with that.
The motion is to Representative Terrio.
Well, I'm not sure I followed all this. And so when a plaintiff files the initial case, that tolls the statutes on the entire issue. And so after the fact, third parties can be brought in, even though they are passed?
I think that's an open question that hasn't been resolved under the law. If the plaintiff chooses not to sue someone that they knew or should have known to investigate and sue, I think they have a real statute of limitations problem. That's my view of it. There's nothing that I know of in the law right now that tolls an action with respect to a third party. And so what happens now, or at least what happened in our case, is that the third-party defendant was not brought in until after this, after the statute of limitations with respect to the plaintiff had run against the third-party defendant. And so the plaintiff did not make a direct claim against the third-party defendant. I think that's an open question, but if you do allow the statute of limitations to toll, then that has another effect, because what that means is you've got potential defendants out there that lose the protection of a two-year statute of limitations. And my view of this whole thing is that it's a pretty simple simple issue in terms of looking back and seeing what the voters voted on. And in almost every instance that I can think of, the plaintiff knows who the parties are and has the ability to investigate those parties. And there just is really no reason that I know of why they can't be brought in by the plaintiff. The other thing I would say is that you don't have a situation of stonewalling like Representative Navarro was talking about. If they're stonewalling, and you know, all the plaintiff has to do is go down to the courthouse, file the claim, and they can force the exchange of information that our civil discovery rules provide. You don't have a situation where stonewalling is responsible for a two-year delay. That really doesn't occur.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in my experience, and at least my understanding, that while, the defendants or potential defendants, even if they have liability, or even if they believe they have liability, their insurance companies or their attorneys don't always step up to the plate and admit that they have some, that they're willing to accept some liability. They defend vigorously against it and will not give information out. And yes, you can go in and file a claim, but the point is, when you're attempting to go forward and file a claim, you try to get as much information as accurate so that you're the plaintiff's claim and the people that they sue, so that they don't sue the wrong people, and so that their claim has the best chance of being successful. Is that not accurate?
I think that what a plaintiff does is a plaintiff looks at who the potential contributors are and who has money. And they make the judgment of whether of who to sue based on whether they have money and what the nature and extent of their liability is. I think that's really it.
Mr. Chairman, I think that statement is for a plaintiff. Many times, a plaintiff, absent an attorney, will attempt to have his claim compensated. And what it sets up is a complete imbalance, because without an attorney, if you're going up against an insurance company, you don't even know in many cases who you're supposed to sue. You don't know who has the money, who has the insurance, any of those things. And I think to suggest that the whole system is based on the fact that the plaintiffs, the injured parties, look at only who has money before they file a suit is both erroneous and inaccurate.
I just would say I don't think they look at only who has money. I think they look at who is at fault and who has contributed and who they can collect from, i.e. who has the ability to pay.
Any other questions? The motion is to rescind our action in failing to adopt Amendment Number 19. And Representative Foster should be right back, I think. Was he coming right back? Or is he just grabbing it? There he is. Representative Foster, we're about to vote on the motion to rescind our action and failing to adopt Amendment Number 19. And there's been objection. Representative Navarro made that motion. So, Luann?
Representative Kelly. Representative Martin.
No.
Representative Mulder.
No.
Representative Navarro.
Yes.
Representative Parnell.
No.
Representative Terrio.
Yes.
Representative Brown.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Hanley.
No.
3 yay, 6 nay.
Failed to rescind our action. Representative Brown, number...
Can I move Amendment 5A at this time?
distributed and it deals with them.
Representative Porter, have you seen 5A? We had talked about this yesterday, and we're trying to come up with a definition of hazardous substance, I believe. Go ahead and move the amendment, Representative.
Move amendment 5A.
I'll hold it just for a second. And,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Porter, I was going to let you.
Mr. Chairman, this is about as inclusive as one could get this coverage, but I, as I said before, I think this is the intent that we were striving for in the first place, and I wouldn't object to the amendment.
Representative Martin.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would have to object, but it confirms what I would suspect, that this is a slight change in word from hazardous waste to hazardous substance. And we are hearing today more and more people complain about cigarette smoke in the buildings. Even the newest thing I've read in the magazine is women complaining about perfumes in the workplace that evidently some are very sensitive to. And we have all kinds of substances that give off odor either in the building or out the building. And here we're talking about the individual's health and welfare. And that's what it all boils down to. It doesn't matter the group, it matters the individual. So one individual can really use it to say that smoke really offends them, perfumes really offend them. I know in my neighborhood, one thing I get uptight with in our condos is people underneath of you use the outside grill, and that propane smell comes up, and it chokes me, so I can't sit on my porch complaining enough about it, so I have to go to the front room. So even though I might like to use this against the guy underneath of me, I don't think it's reasonable to say substance in this particular issue, and especially when it comes to personal health. I think we would be stopping anything that projects an odor or projects a fume of some nature in the air.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I share some of the concerns by Representative Martin. However, I do understand that we do need to provide some protection for people, that the injury is not necessarily present or prevalent within the first 8 years.
Yeah.
But my concern with this definition, Mr. Chairman, goes to the last two lines, and I propose amending this definition. I don't think this tort action needs to cover fish, animals, or vegetation. Mm-hmm. So I propose that we strike everything after the words health and welfare, and put a period there, and then strike or to fish, animals, vegetation, or any other part of the natural habitat in which fish, animals, or wildlife may be found.
Yes.
So I'd put a period after welfare.
I propose the amendment. Is there any objection to that amendment to the amendment? Hearing none, that's been adopted. Did you get that, Luann?
Mm-hmm. Well,
Representative Martin.
I'm glad you caught that one, Ed. I was going for the individual as being more important than the fish and the animals. But still, like, you want to talk about the individual. Here we go again with car fumes, with other vehicles that give off noxious fumes and gas. And it's called a substance. And does it go on the water? Does it go on the ground? Does it go in your lungs? Yes. And that's what I'm afraid of. This new concept of substance can be so stretched out. Whereas the courts and the insurance companies and the business people are used to the word hazardous waste now. But substance is a new thing, and I wonder if we're the first ones that are going that far in the nation. I wonder if our lawyers, is there any other state or place that uses the word substance now in place of waste?
Senator Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think this is that new. This definition is similar to the one right now in 4608-900, and I'd respectfully say, you know, if we were doing this on a normal work day instead of a Sunday afternoon, we'd be able to have the lawyers here to answer some of Representative Martin's questions about it. I don't know all the history and everything of all these definitions, but I think, you know, the one that's before us says presents an imminent and substantial danger. An imminent substantial danger. So I doubt car fumes would fall into that category.
Representative Terrell, did you have a question? Any other comments? There's been an objection, Luann.
Representative Martin.
No.
Representative Mulder.
Yes.
Representative Navarre.
Yes.
Representative Parnell.
Yes.
Representative Terrio.
Yes.
Representative Brown.
Yes.
Representative Kelly.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Hanley.
Yes.
2 nay, 7 yay.
So 5A has been adopted. Representative Brown, number 21.
Mr. Chairman, there's a, yesterday in the packet that was distributed, there was an amendment between number 21 and number 22 that did not have a, that just, I think, inadvertently did not get numbered.
Right, it got stapled with 21.
Right.
And you handed out a 21A.
I would like to withdraw that, the one that's stapled to the back of 21. It's similar to what's now labeled 21A, but it's different. So we're striking, we're not using the one that was distributed yesterday, and I'm inserting this other one, 21A, in its place, but it's kind of an alternative way to look at it. Maybe I could just...
Did you want to do 21 or 21A first? Did you want to do 21 or 21A first? We do have amendment number 21.
Yes, we do, and they're both related to the same subject.
Right, one deletes the whole...
One deletes it, and the other... changes what's in the bill.
So how did you want to proceed? Do you want to do 21 first? Or do you want to...
Well, the outcome is not too terribly much different between them, I suppose.
Okay, whichever, I'm just asking, which one, why don't you move one?
I'll move 21A.
21A, everybody have that? Okay. I'll object for discussion.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, this bill changes the interest rate on judgments from 10.5% to a floating rate, 3% above the Federal Reserve discount rate. It's been asserted that this is an attempt by insurance companies to secure a windfall at the expense of injured persons who are forced to litigate in order to be compensated. A prudent investor can earn substantially more than 3% above the federal discount rate. This provision in the bill would give insurance companies an incentive to delay litigation and to delay paying valid claims because it would be cheaper for them to delay and not pay and get to use the money when the interest rate is set too low. The state of Alaska gets on delinquent taxes, we get a rate set 5% above the Federal Reserve rate or 11%, whichever is higher. What I did in this proposed 21A amendment would be to change the provision to say a similar provision, 5% above the federal or 10.5%, whichever is less, given that the current fixed rate in the statute is 10.5%. So this would be, you know, a slight, if we were to adopt this amendment, it would be slightly less fair to victims than the status quo, but certainly better than the provision that's in the bill. So I think it's a good compromise and would urge your consideration of it.
Representative Mulder?
Okay, I guess conceptually I can see where there's value to having a floating rate as opposed to a fixed rate because it cuts both ways. There are going to be times when the return is higher or lower with the 10.5, the fixed rate, whereas if it's floating, it's going to be in real dollar terms of the time. So I think the concept of establishing a floating mark seems to be have merit. The argument over the... but what this amendment also does is it basically sets as a floor 11%. And that's the argument against this amendment. I mean, the floor is 11%. That's the absolute minimum. The second half? I'm sorry, I had a structure off yesterday's.
21A.
Yeah. Sorry. But it establishes...
Actually, it doesn't set as a four, does it?
Whichever is less. Yeah, no, you just turned around. I'm sorry, I had deals on yesterday.
So if the federal discount rate was 4% and they had 3, it could be 7.
It would be 7, five. Whichever is less.
Which is 5.
Or 5 plus that. But
right, five,
no easy one.
So then the argument comes back to what is a more appropriate floating rate, you know, 3% above or 5%. I don't have a great conservative index,
10%,
I think, is what you're generally aiming at, and 3% above prime generally seems to be a pretty conservative index to me, and that's generally the way things flow.
Representative Brown, it just seems to me that the second part, we should be debating how much above the federal rate. I think it makes, because what your amendment does is say if the federal discount rate goes to 16%, that the injured party that gets interest will still only be at 10.5.
That's what's provided in the current law, which is why I don't
right.
want it to be worse for people than well, current law, which right now, because the federal rate is only 5.5, you add 3 or 5, it's 5.25. As of March 2nd, it was 5.25, so you add 3 to that, and you're giving essentially that windfall to the insurance company to encourage them not to pay, and that's a significantly lower amount than we get for other judgments, for other similar situations, and why do we want to give a break to the insurance companies in this situation and encourage them not to pay the claims that are owed?
Representative Porter?
I just, briefly, I don't follow the logic. The floating rate provides equity to both sides. And we've had swings to rates of 18-20% and then went way down.
Representative Brown, I think you ought to just withdraw the second part of your amendment and debate what level above the federal. I think we're trying to go where you... The current bill does remove the 10.5 floor. So I think under your amendment, you're going to hurt people worse if the interest rate goes high because you're going to set it at 10.5%. Whereas under even Representative Porter's bill, let's say the federal discount rate went to 13%. Under Representative Porter's bill, the interest set would be 16%. And under your amendment, it would be 10.5%.
Okay, I'll take that as a friendly suggestion. I'll ask to withdraw the second part of the amendment.
As an amendment, any objection to that?
Leaving only the page 12, line 21.
Representative Foster?
I just wanted to add, I remember in 1977, I was going to buy a twin-engine plane, and the interest rates under the president then had jumped up to 22%, and the prime for a business to borrow on a loan would have been 25%. This would have been stuck at 10.5. But then it's out with 3 over prime anyway whenever you try to get a loan, so that seemed fair to me. Yeah. But the ceiling certainly didn't.
Okay, so there was no opposition to eliminate. I think we're back to the floating rate now, no matter how high or low it goes. Now the question is what level above the federal reserve district discount rate is in effect is there. In the current bill, it's 3. Representative Brown's amendment is 5. She's made an argument as to why it should be 5.
And even if we adopted 5, Mr. Chairman, it would still be less than the rate now provided in the statute today. But it would be close.
Any other questions? Ma'am?
Representative Martin.
No.
Representative Mulder.
No.
Representative Navarre.
Yes.
Representative Parnell.
No.
Representative Terrio.
No.
Representative Brown.
Yes.
Representative Grusendorf.
Yes.
Representative Kelly.
No.
Representative Hanley.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
3A, 7A.
So I'll withdraw number 21.
Which it hasn't been offered. Representative Navarre.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we'll move amendment number 22.
I'll object for discussion. I think the effect of this being in the statutes is that there will basically be no prejudgment interest because most of the claim, I think, would be shown as future economic damages or future non-economic damages, pain and suffering, loss of consortium, things like that. And I just think that, you know, if I were comfortable that the level of compensation in the bill was fair, I wouldn't be nearly so concerned about this. But I think that what this does is further imbalance, because there's virtually no risk now. The idea that prejudgment interest might be used in order to try to force fair settlements goes out the window if this is left in the bill, because there will be virtually no prejudgment interest, because most of the claim will be for future economic or non-economic damages. And I think that certainly would be what would be asserted by the defense in these situations.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Westmeyer, could you explain fully to the committee prejudgment interest? What exactly we're talking about here was as provided for about future economic damages, future non-economic damages, or punitive damages. What exactly does, how does that apply?
The way it works right now is that prejudgment interest starts to run from the time that there is written notice of the claim sent to the defendant. And it starts to run at 10.5% per annum. There was a ruling by the Supreme Court just around the first of the year, this year, towards the end, in a case involving Navistar Transportation up there in Anchorage, in which the court said that there no longer is prejudgment interest on future economic loss, because we discount the present value. And so the way it works now is you get prejudgment interest for all of the damages that are past damages as of the amount of trial. For example, if you were to draw a line down the center of your paper, on the one side you could put your past medical expenses, your past wage loss, past pain and suffering, past loss of enjoyment of life, and you would get prejudgment interest, as the statute now says, 10.5% per annum from the date that you give notice. As the law is right now, you would also get prejudgment interest on the future damages, except for the economic loss. So you would get prejudgment interest on future pain and suffering, future loss of enjoyment of life. That basically is the way the system works.
Representative Mulder, then Kelly.
I guess I'm amazed to hear that you can get interest on something that you haven't earned. You know, within appraisal work, you devalue things in the future to present value.
With economics.
But in this sense, you're not devaluing, you're revaluing higher. I guess I don't understand the logic when they drew this, why they included that.
Representative Kelly, and then
Representative Mulder is amazed. I'm still confused. I understand discounting and all that. But you kind of lost me when, if you have non-economic damages, and there's a ruling on that. And then that's where I get lost.
Mr. Chairman,
maybe the future, put it into the past, and then accrue interest.
Well, what happens is that from the date of your letter, you would accrue not only on the past damages from that date, but on the future damages, except for the economic loss right now.
Also, they would take the entire amount of the
right.
settlement.
Except for the economic loss. The future economic loss, which is discounted to present value to the date of trial.
So you take that entire number and then accrue interest on it up to the date of judgment.
But you accrue it up to the date of the judgment, prejudgment interest, and then there would be post-judgment interest at the same rate afterwards.
Representative Noir?
Excuse me. Under this, though, all they would do is they would still get prejudgment interest for that amount from...
They would get prejudgment interest on... all of the past, in other words, everything that is in the past, and then as of the moment of the verdict or whatever, they would get post-judgment interest on all of the future.
Chairman, I'd like to offer another example. In this case, the gross disfigurement because of a burn, excruciating pain for the rest of your life, loss of consortium, likely earning potential still available because you have all your mental faculties and use of limbs and things like that. You take $300,000, you divide it by for a 22-year-old, whatever the likely number of years that he would live under the statistical tables for to decide how long he's going to live, and then all of that's future. You know, for 50 years, that's what's going to happen, and you've already limited the non-economic award. And now what you're suggesting is that that loss, which would happen over the entire period of time, after limiting it to $300,000, you're saying that to the companies, because that's the only portion, the only big part of the claim in this case, is the $300,000 for the gross disfigurement and pain and suffering, that there is no penalty to taking, delaying this, forcing all kinds of frivolous motions, which plaintiffs' attorneys are not the only ones who do that. Discovery in cases like this is forced by the defense.
What's the rate of post-judgment?
In past testimony that I've heard, much of the cost in litigation is due to the fact that a lot of what has to be recovered is because the defense won't come up with it. You have to go through all these discoveries, very expensive discovery motions. So in this case, the entire delay could be over the fact that there is virtually zero penalty in terms of prejudgment interest on the claim. That's what I believe it would be the case.
I think the response to that is, I think it's unfair to always say that it's one side or the other, Representative Noir. I really do. I think there is great incentive to settle claims quickly, because if claims are settled quickly, they don't have to go out and hire somebody like me. The reason you have a trial, and ultimately you're going to have some trials, and that is because people disagree, and nobody's going to be right every time, and nobody's going to be wrong. So you're going to have trials, even if everybody's motivations are good. The penalties that are set forth in this bill are the ones that are contained in the offer of judgment provision, and those are great penalties. There is also a prejudgment interest penalty that will always occur with respect to past economic loss, past loss of any kind. I guess it would be economic or non-economic. So there's going to be a prejudgment interest penalty and an incentive to settle for that reason, but also an incentive to settle just to get litigation over with. Nobody likes litigation. Nobody does. And I think that what you see is you actually see probably upwards of 90 to 95% of the cases are ultimately settled and ultimately resolved for that reason.
Yeah. Chairman, again, I'm not an expert in the insurance field, but, you know, in my limited experience, the company, many times the companies in all kinds of these claims will settle. They want to settle. Their goal is to get out and get settled, but it's on their terms. And if they can't have it on their terms, oftentimes there's the threat, implied or otherwise, that you can fight. We'll fight you over this for as long as you want, because we don't have to give you anything till we lose. So I don't mean to set it up as the insurance company's always being a bad guy. I think that there are plaintiffs' attorneys who file frivolous lawsuits. I think there are defense attorneys who require frivolous discovery motions. I think there are defense attorneys who won't settle or who force ridiculous settlements or settlement offers on legitimate plaintiffs. So I think that there's both sides in this. The reason I'm arguing this side is that this bill, in my opinion, is so heavily weighted to the defense side, is why I keep offering the argument on the plaintiff side, is that I believe this is so imbalanced that it makes it hard for me to view the other side, because the one side, it seems, has been put in such a hole.
Mr. Chairman, just to wrap up.
Representative Brown had a question, I believe, and then.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to add something to the context of this. It's my understanding that before the changes that we made in 86, interest went back to the time of the injury. And then there was this reform that said interest would go from the time that the lawsuit was filed. Well, I'm passing on information that was given to me by the Alaska Action Trust, which I just note, you know, partly it bothers me we're having this conversation with only one party here
I can assure you that interest right now does not run from the time the lawsuit is filed. It runs from the time that there is written notice of the claim. And if you want, I mean, I can
Thank
get
you.
The statute
the
out and show you.
The lawsuit is filed or and served on the wrongdoer. The wrongdoer receives notice, and that could be the filing of the suit, could it not?
It could be the filing of the suit, but it's not only the filing of the suit. It just has to be written notice.
Okay, thank you for that. But anyway, what we're talking about now is from that point, as I see it, the current situation does give people an incentive to go ahead and get the situation resolved because they know they're going to have interest back to that point, and that's what prejudgment interest is. It's the interest from the time that either the suit was filed or the person got notice that there was a problem until there's a judgment. And so the fact that if you're found at fault, you're going to pay interest on that back to that point gives you the incentive to settle. And then when you take that away, you have the reverse kind of incentive, which is the incentive not to settle because they're not going to, if you're really wronged and you are owed that money, you're just letting the insurance companies keep it or the plaintiff or the defendant keep it all that period of time. And in fact, their incentive is to keep the judgment from happening as long as possible because there's no nothing they would owe for that period of delay.
Representative Porter.
Thank you. I think there's a misunderstanding. We're not changing the fact that prejudgment interest will accrue, be required to be paid from the date that notice is given to the defendant to the time of the disposition of the case. We're not changing that. What we're saying is that prejudgment interest should be by definition prejudgment, pre-decision. So it is. It accrues until the time of the disposition of the case, and then post-judgment interest starts accruing from the time of that judgment until the award is made. But what we're saying is we're trying to eliminate windfalls. It's been characterized as a defense bill. My take on it is that the plaintiffs have had an advantage for it low these many years, and we're trying to level it back. And I think this amendment speaks to that. Pre-judgment interest should accrue for interest due from the time the notice is given to the disposition of the case. That's pre-judgment. Why in the heck should it accrue after the judgment? By definition, it's pre-judgment interest.
We have different... I agree with you, Representative Porter. We have different reasons for some people wanting different things. Representative Parnell.
Representative Porter, I agree with, in principle, with where you're headed. I just have a question about the scope of Section 19. And I want to ask you, I understand the consistency with what you're saying with future economic damages, with future non-economic damages, because those are in the future. What's the policy behind including punitive damages in that same category? Because that is conduct. We're punishing conduct that's occurred in the past. We're not compensating for something in the future. So is there an inconsistency there? And why are we including punitive damages in this list?
There's no prejudgment interest on punitive damages,
okay.
Right?
That's. I want to make sure that that's clear here.
Representative Navarro.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, with respect to the plaintiff's attorneys or whatever having the advantage currently, what we have is a jury system, and Representative Porter does not trust citizens of the state of Alaska who sit and make judgment in a jury panel, that is fine. But in fact, I do, so I don't think that it's imbalanced so much as it is a reflection of what the public in these cases deem their best judgment, their best decision. And with respect to future non-economic damages, I guess I wonder how you calculate that. If the example that Mr. Feldman gave yesterday, where the person essentially was castrated, how much of that goes into the future? If the kid's 22 years old or 20 years old, how do you calculate that? Is that loss immediately, or is that the loss for the rest of the time of his life?
Mr. Lesmeyer.
What there is now is there's an itemized verdict form that would set it out for, require the jury to award categories of damage for past economic loss, past wage loss,
and how is that made currently?
Well, with the economic damages, it's just numbers. In other words, you can usually tell very clearly what the past wage loss has been, and usually there's no dispute about that, and usually there's no dispute about past medical expenses. The intangible damages are argued by both sides.
Thank you.
And for both past and for future, but it is set out in verdict forms right now.
No.
Representative Terrio?
No.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Grusendorf?
Yes.
Representative Kelly?
No.
Representative Martin?
No.
Representative Foster?
No.
Representative Hanley?
No.
3 yea, 7 nay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Amendment number 23 addresses the hospitals, and I am still sort of confused over some of the provisions of it. I regret that we're having this conversation when people are not available to assist us understanding this bill, and so I'll withdraw number 23. Mr. Chairman, it's 24 I want to withdraw, and 23 I want to offer.
Okay. So 24 won't be up.
24 deals with the hospital. 23 deals with the witnesses.
Okay. Before you begin, I believe that lines 3, 4, and 5 can be scratched out on yours because we already deleted that section of the bill. So if everybody, I think, if you agree, Representative Brown?
Yes.
Would just scratch off 3, 4, and 5. I think that takes care of what we've already deleted. Would you like to move amendment number 23?
I'll move amendment number 23.
Reject.
They would limit the pool of people who were available to testify by providing, for example, that they'd have to be of the same specialty. That's on page, the whole section 21 that I'm addressing is on page 13 of the bill. That they would have to be certified by a board recognized by the state medical board, that they'd have to have been in active practice within 1 year. And yesterday, you know, Mr. Feldman discussed some of the reasons that those are not reasonable restrictions, because we can think of retired people or people who haven't been in practice within 1 year who would still be very competent witnesses in a trial, and that we should leave this matter to be determined as a matter of foundation in the courts, as it's done now, for the judge to look at the qualifications and make some reasonable judgment as to whether the people that are proposed to be witnesses in the trial are in fact qualified, and why do we need to say these kinds of restrictions when we know that it's going to increase the cost, make it more difficult for people who are injured to find witnesses for them. So I move, if I didn't already, I'll move number 23.
You had already moved it. Okay. Objected to. Representative Porter?
Go ahead. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The section that is being asked to be removed is obviously a policy call. It is attempting to address a concern within the medical community that there are hired guns that you can obtain to provide expert testimony on a point of view as opposed to current state-qualified, state-recognized experts to give objective testimony. The criteria that's established by this goes towards establishing a criteria that will guarantee that a medical expert's information will be current, and that because of his currency, either in the profession within a year or teaching, and that it meets the standards set in this state for that medical qualification. It makes sense to me. So.
Representative Navarro?
Yeah. Mr. Porter, Representative Porter, do you think that let's assume that you have two doctors who are equally well qualified. One lives in Anchorage, practices in the medical community, and with another doctor in Alaska who he's expected to testify against, versus someone who is just as well qualified, perhaps more so, but let's assume that they're equally qualified, from another jurisdiction who does not know the doctor, doesn't practice in this community, which one do you think is going to be more objective?
I don't think that there would be a distinction if they're equally qualified.
You don't think the fact that a doctor may practice in the same medical community, live in the same town. We have relatively small, not by perhaps per capita, but certainly just because of the size of the population of the state, a fairly limited pool. And can you truly say that you believe that a doctor who lives, practices, knows many or all of the other doctors in the same community is going to be just as objective with respect to the type of testimony he might provide as someone who doesn't have any of those types of ties?
I could only say that it would depend on the individual, and there are varying degrees of ability to remain objective in each of us, so I couldn't answer the question, but I will have to add that this provision doesn't preclude a licensed physician from outside to testify.
Also, with respect to this policy call, and I know that the legislature arguably has the jurisdiction to do so, but do you think the courts are incapable of making the types of distinctions between qualified
I think if
expert
I was
witnesses? Do you think that the expertise with respect to how you judge who's qualified expertise, what should be allowed into evidence, the expertise and the experience for that lies with the state Supreme Court or with the legislature?
I think what we're suggesting here is that the best people to determine the ability to provide medical expert testimony is the state-appointed legislative confirmed medical board comprised of people who are professional in this area. In effect, that's what this is.
We have Representative Terrio, Bruce Mulder, and then Brown.
Right now, if you have a witness that comes in, I'm just wondering about this section, which is on page 13, lines 22 through 27, basically says that a person who's coming from out of state to testify is granted the privilege of practicing in the state for that purpose. That seems to make sense. Is there a prohibition against that right now? How do we handle that right now, or you can't bring people up?
Their qualifications would be accepted by the board, and that is the method for obtaining ability to practice in the state.
So is this current statute, or
No, it's an addition because this is a dealing with expert testimony as opposed to actually practicing. But in effect, it's the same process.
I see.
Representative Brewster.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding of this isn't that great, but I was just thinking here on this medical expert. Family physicians and surgeons and other things that have been with the family for a good number of years do retire. They get old too. And maybe have a great understanding as well as past records on an individual. Then they retire, and 3 or 4 years later, something happens to one of their old patients. Are you saying this then would not allow that person to be brought in as a professional witness, or would the person just come in as a... I was just wondering about that, because... would you explain that to me?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're looking at Mr. Lesmeyer, and he's...
That's right. I don't see this as having any application in that situation. The only place it has application is for an outside witness who has no connection with the case, who's hired separate and apart from, did not give treatment, to come up and testify about a doctor's the standard of care here in Alaska. And I think this basically cuts both ways. I mean, it's not just, it doesn't just apply to plaintiff's witnesses, it applies to all witnesses. And I think what this bill is addressed at, and at least my understanding of it anyway, is to, doctors are specialized by, they pass board tests. Many doctors, wherever they are board certified. Like you have a board certified orthopedic surgeon or a board certified family practitioner or a board certified ER doc. Those are national boards that are given. And I think that is what this is probably trying to recognize, is saying that if a doctor is going to come up here and testify, they ought to be recognized by this board, and they ought to be in active practice, and they ought to be of the same specialty that the doctor is that they're critiquing.
So, Mr. Chairman, so that doctor that has a past history and records on a given patient can follow that patient up to Alaska, even though they're retired, and even indicate that by their records they told the physician who is being sued, these are the circumstances, you know, of the passing information, circumstances dealing with this, and 5 years later something happened. He said, I told him not to use that medication. So, in other words, I can be... You're telling me that I don't have to worry about a retired physician following up the...
I don't think that is at all the intent of this bill.
Representative Mulder, Brown.
I have two quick questions, Mr. Chairman. Currently, Mr. Esmeyer does, is the amount of compensation provided to an outside witness, is that not admissible in court?
It is admissible.
It is not? It is?
It is admissible.
Okay. So why are we saying, outlining that it is, if it is already? Just clarifying or... Okay. The second question I had, let's do page 14, lines 6, 7, and 8, relating to contingency fees for third parties. What exactly does that pertain to?
My understanding... Is that there's a concern about witnesses who have some stake in the litigation. In other words, where a witness is compensated based on whether they win or whether they don't. And if they win, they get a percentage of the amount of the recovery.
Does that happen?
I don't see it.
So in other words, you have an expert medical expert testimony. And he's not given any compensation, but a slice of the pie of contingency? Is that what you're saying?
I think that's the concern.
Chairman, if I can, some of these things perhaps don't happen in Alaska now, but I see nothing wrong with some preventative statutes that would preclude it from ever occurring. The idea of an expert supposedly coming up and giving objective testimony,
right,
being paid on a contingent fee of how much is recovered, seems to be a slight conflict of interest towards objectivity.
So the net essence of this element of the bill is basically preventing people who are medical experts outside, who really don't have a related interest to the field to which the person is being, the case is being tried on, from coming outside, coming up here, providing medical expert testimony when they really don't have a particular interest or expertise within that field. Is that correct? Is that what you're trying to?
Yes.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. With respect to subsection B that Representative Mulder brought up, if I could read just a piece out of the Alaska Action Plus. It says, paragraph B is problematic. When read literally, it would preclude law firms or sole practitioners from associating with other law firms in medical malpractice cases. For example, if a law firm associated with a sole practitioner engaged in a split contingency fee and provided a medical expert as part of that agreement, the defense could challenge the admissibility of such testimony under this statutory framework. Even more troubling, it could be read to preclude any law firm from taking a malpractice case on a contingency because, by necessity, lawyers have to contract with an expert to render testimony. Lawyers are the third party and have a contingency agreement. As such, the statute may prohibit attorney participation. On the other hand, if the statute is meant only to prohibit contracting with outside or within the state organizations whose sole business is arranging medical expert witnesses, it would be unethical to enter into such a contingency agreement with such a non-lawyer entity in the first place. There are organizations, including those headed up by licensed attorneys, whose sole practice is limited to reviewing medical legal cases and obtaining viable expert witnesses. So perhaps, Representative Porter, could you tell us which of those two interpretations
certainly
is your intention or is correct?
Mr. Chairman, it is not the intent of Section B, line 6 on page 14, to indicate that the third party is the law firm that's involved in the case. The third party would be, and there are agencies like this, a broker for emergency or for medical testimony, and literally available by what opinion do you want? And that's what this legislation is trying to preclude.
Representative Noir.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'd like some further clarification. Can you provide us with the names of these types of agencies, and or is that anecdotal information offered by defense attorneys or plaintiff's attorneys or both? Is it hearsay?
May I answer that question?
I have a personal experience in this.
Representative Kelly.
I was in a personal injury suit some time ago. I was referred to the insurance company, or by the insurance company, to a doctor who did nothing else but take claims from this insurance company, injured parties from this insurance company, give them examinations, and then go ahead and give the insurance company's view of the injury. That was his sole purpose in life. He didn't have a practice. He didn't see any other patients but who were referred to him by this insurance company and various lawyers and whatnot. I don't know the name of it. I did have a personal experience in it, though.
Chairman, I have no doubt that there are both plaintiffs, doctors, and defense doctors. I mean, I've heard this before, too, but never quite, I think, so blatantly as Representative Porter stated it, and that is that, what do you want me to say, basically? I think that undoubtedly, the doctors probably for the insurance company would try to make sure that they would weight it towards whatever their clients' needs are. I don't have any doubt of that, but I just think that the way it was characterized may be somewhat misleading. I have a couple of questions, though, or at least one question for Mr. Lesmeyer, and that is with respect to the language on page 14, line 13, and page 14, beginning at line 6, would you say that works? Because you've argued or you've suggested that this is all a fair application. It impacts both sides. Would you say that the effect of those two areas would impact the defense or the plaintiffs? And which one would you say would impact it more?
Talking about the contingent fee,
yes.
I'm not aware that this is being done right now. I haven't run across that in my practice, and I guess I don't know.
If it were being done, since we're apparently addressing a problem maybe that doesn't exist, if it is being done, which side would you expect might be more likely to do the contingent fee arrangement?
If somebody were going to do this, it could be done on either side. I mean, you could go out, and I would question whether this is ethical, because I think it's probably not ethical to begin with. But a defense lawyer, if he wants to avoid ethical considerations, might go out and say, "All right, doctor, I'd like to hire you, and I'll pay you X amount of dollars if we win, and nothing if we lose." So it could be done on both sides. Maybe contingent fees are more frequently something that is done on the plaintiff's side. I can't tell you because in a situation like this, because I haven't seen it.
Chairman, I'd say that they probably are done more on the plaintiff's side, and the reason for that is that the plaintiff, in those cases, doesn't have many times any assets to work with. And so that, and I don't know whether this is being done or not, but if it is being done, it's probably being done because there may not be any money to pay for the expert witnesses unless there's some successful judgment. And while on the other side, there's a vested interest in paying to make sure that a successful judgment is not achieved.
Representative Parnell. I'm just trying to work through the whole section because I struggle with carving out. To me, all experts are hired guns, whether they're in the medical realm or any other realm. They're all paid to represent a particular side in a lawsuit, and they each come with their own opinions, their own backgrounds, and the jury hears those backgrounds, and they can decide whether or not this person is more, whether they're going to believe this person versus another person. So I'm not particularly I'm not sure what problem is being addressed here that isn't prevalent in all areas of the law.
Mr. Chairman, very briefly, my take on this and the explanation that I got on the problems that exist are principally outside, but Alaska is that kind of state that eventually the problems of America come up here. That's what they're trying to establish in statute to preclude it from even starting up here. But in general terms, even for up here, I agree that you certainly seek out experts that will support your position. To the extent that that happens, this is going to limit the ability to, or this is going to guarantee as high a level of objectivity, I would think, as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also have some questions and want to bring the committee's attention